The Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department are a little bit on the outs. We will talk about that. Also, this week in this economy, of course, from American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 20th of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. There are days, of which this is one, when we are obliged by the news to get just a touch down in the weeds. So we will, because we have to, but we'll do it gently. Back in March, in the CARES Act, Congress authorized the Treasury Department to let the Federal Reserve use about $450 billion to fund a bunch of Fed lending programs. Programs that would, and remember, back in March and April, the fear factor was pretty high in this economy, right? These programs would stabilize credit markets and, in a way, thus backstop the whole economy. Well, yesterday, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin told Fed Chair Jay Powell he wants the money back. In other words, those lending programs, the secretary said, are done. The Fed, not known for its political loquaciousness, said in a statement yesterday afternoon it would prefer the money and the emergency programs stay where they are. But this afternoon, Chair Powell wrote to Secretary Mnuchin and told him the money's on the way. So we will get to the what it all means thing with Lynette Lopez and Gina Smilek in a minute. But first, Marketplace's Sabri Benishore with what exactly these programs did.
In different ways, these programs all allowed the Fed to get down and dirty in the mud of credit markets. So, for example, a couple of them allowed the Fed to actually buy corporate bonds. Another allowed the Fed to buy short-term bonds from state and local governments. Another allowed it to indirectly buy up car loans and student loans.
They essentially stood there and said, you know, we'll be a buyer of these things. We'll support these markets.
Yusuf Abbasi is global market strategist at StoneX. Now, the reason we care that the Fed could buy these securities is that for a while there in this pandemic, it was looking like nobody else would. And if nobody wants to buy up, for example, loans, people aren't going to get as many loans. And loans are what kept some businesses alive and local governments functioning.
You're talking about essentially the entire credit markets could have nearly froze if the Fed didn't step in with these facilities.
The Fed supported credit markets so credit markets could support people. Chris Campbell is chief strategist at Duff & Phelps and former assistant secretary of the Treasury.
They allow for there to be liquidity or money available to banks or institutions to have them to be able to lend you money.
By all accounts, these programs worked. Edward Altman is professor of finance emeritus at NYU.
The Treasury felt that it has succeeded so well that it's no longer necessary.
Altman sees that as ill-advised, given the looming threat of further shutdowns. But Secretary Mnuchin has said businesses need grants now, not loans. The $455 billion in question could be repurposed into a miniature stimulus deal before a new president is sworn in. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
As promised, Gina Smilek from The New York Times, Lynette Lopez from Business Insider. Hey, you two.
Hi, Ken. Hi.
So, Gina, let me start with you and the what is going on here. First of all, the unusual sort of disagreement, I guess, between the Treasury and the Fed and why it's happening.
Yeah. So this is some drama. This is like the most dramatic story I've ever covered. And I've been covering the Fed for 7 years. So basically, I think that basically this is a political squabble, and that's how we should understand it. So the Fed and Treasury were looking at potentially extending these emergency loan programs past the end of the year. Suddenly, the Treasury has decided that congressional intent means that it can't do that. And so really, it's taking these programs off the table just as the Biden administration comes into office. Now, obviously, they're citing legal reasons, but Secretary Mnuchin is going out and saying, hey, you know, like as an added bonus, we can go ahead and repurpose this money. But the problem with that is the money was scored as deficit neutral when the Congressional Budget Office scored this law. So it's not like you can just take this money and spend it. It doesn't add to the deficit. It absolutely would add to the deficit, just like any new spending would. And so, you know, this has become this like real drama. And I think the Fed, for its part, really kind of like made a pretty shocking statement in responding to this and saying, hey, like, we would really like to extend these if you would just give us that option. And the Treasury clearly isn't.
Well, and you know, if you read Chair Powell's letter this afternoon, Lynette, the language is fairly frosty. He's clearly not pleased. What do you think, Lynette, of the idea that the outgoing administration is saying now to President-elect Biden, you're on your own?
Yeah, nice economy there. Wouldn't want anything to go wrong with it. No, I mean, Chairman Powell is clearly frustrated, and he's one of the few adults in Washington who still talks to the White House. And I think he realizes that Trump is in a position where he wants to burn everything down. Mnuchin, who has been trying to play both sides, is probably not seeing a lot of potential to do that anymore. It doesn't seem like there's going to be another stimulus package. And this, if this looks like irrational behavior, it's because it is. It's because it's politically motivated by a man, Donald Trump, who has really not, he hasn't cared about how America does through this crisis for a long time. And he certainly doesn't care now that he's a lame duck president. I mean, his schedule has been publicly empty since he lost.
Gina, how come the markets today with this squabble between Treasury and the Fed, right? It's like when your parents fight. How come the markets didn't just go, oh, my God, what's going on?
So I think that it's going to take some time to dawn on everybody exactly what this means. You know, I think that these facilities clearly served as a backstop. Right now, markets are feeling fairly confident that we're getting a vaccine. But I think the real question and the real test is going to come when you get some bad news. Like, what happens if one of these vaccine trials goes badly? What happens if there's some sort of setback? And the Fed facilities aren't obviously going to be there at scale to back it up. And I think we just can't know that in a day. You know, I think it's going to take time to see how that plays out.
Here's another what happens, Lynette. What happens if there's no fiscal relief from Washington before the inauguration and even beyond that with the Republicans conceivably maintaining control of the Senate?
It's a scary prospect. A lot of Americans, you know, we have unemployment benefits running out for millions of Americans the day after Christmas, as if Dickens was writing this novel himself. It's just like, I don't know how many ways can I say it would be bad for everyone, people who don't have jobs, corporates who still need to lend. You know, Americans have been running through their savings. Consumption is what keeps this economy afloat. And so when people stop spending, this economy stops running. I mean, I don't know how many different ways to say it. It's Econ 101. And if, like I said, if this doesn't make sense, it's because it's not supposed to. It's not about you or me or any of the voters. This is about Donald Trump and how he feels about America right now, which is not great.
Gina, real quick on an interview I did with John Williams from the New York Fed this week as part of that CBU conference that you may or may not have heard part of. He, it seems to me, was, you know, he acknowledged it could be tricky between here and Inauguration Day if there's no relief. But he seemed reasonably upbeat. And I wonder why central bankers seem to think that the recovery has gone pretty well so far.
I would say that central bankers are actually pretty divided on that point. I think if you talk to folks like John Williams or Vice Chair Richard Clarida, they do seem fairly upbeat. I think they've seen the real data coming in and it's looking pretty solid and the vaccine is coming and that's all good news. I think if you talk to people like Chair Powell, they're a little bit more concerned because at the end of the day, we've got these virus cases surging and states are locking down and we don't have a lot of government support out there. And so I think what you get is a really bifurcated sort of outlook, and as a result, some pretty bifurcated central bankers.
Yeah, no, that's fair. That's a good point. Okay, real quick, a different central banker in conceivably a new job. Lynette, some reporting out there today that Janet Yellen is in line to be the Secretary of the Treasury. Discuss.
Hey, I would just be happy with a treasurer or Secretary of the Treasury who is apolitical in a sense and cares about the well-being of the citizens of the United States and is not a crony. Janet Yellen has a lot of wealth of experience. She was a great Fed chair. We know how she works. I think it's a fine idea. Go with it.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see what happens. We'll see what happens. Yeah. Lynette Lopez.
We'll see what happens.
We will see what happens. Lynette Lopez, Business Insider. Gina Smilek at the New York Times. Thanks, you two. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks, Scott.
Talk to you soon. Have a good weekend. Wall Street on this Friday. Kind of underwhelmed. Actually, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. California is now the fourth and largest state to put emergency workplace protections into place for the coronavirus. Virginia, Michigan, and Oregon are the other three, in case you're curious. Nearly 20 million workers here are going to be covered by the new mandate, which would include specific requirements for masks and physical distancing and reporting of outbreaks, all measures that aren't legally required at the federal level. But as Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports, that might change.
The Federal Occupational Safety and Health Administration usually sets specific enforceable rules for dealing with workplace dangers, like hazardous chemicals and bloodborne diseases, but not for COVID-19.
There was no guidance anywhere really for people.
Maggie Robbins is a safety advocate with the nonprofit WorkSafe, which collaborated with California regulators on their new emergency rules.
There's no way we can control the broader circulation of COVID if we keep having outbreaks at workplaces.
California regulators will have new tools to enforce mask wearing and physical distancing, and employers will be required to investigate, report, and test for potential outbreaks. But Robert Mutri with the California Chamber of Commerce says that could unfairly burden employers as community spread surges.
You may have no role in those cases appearing in your workplace, but you will be put under outbreak protocols here.
Large workplace outbreaks have been documented at meatpacking plants, garment factories, and among farm workers across the country, and incidents of workplace infections are growing. That's why the federal government needs to follow the lead of states like California, says Rebecca Reindel with the AFL-CIO.
The virus doesn't know boundaries, and you need national leadership to set those plans.
The labor group will be making recommendations to the Biden transition team for who should lead OSHA. The president-elect has said enacting national workplace safety rules is a high priority. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Adversity can sometimes breed innovation, and something like that seems to be happening in the theater and television world. There are two main actors' unions out there. Actors Equity represents live stage performers and workers, and SAG-AFTRA does television and film workers. And as circumstances necessarily require more hybrid-type performances and less live, the theater folks want to make content for streaming. Streaming, though, kind of belongs to the TV and film union. But as Marketplace's Erica Barris reports, the show must go on.
With theaters indefinitely shut down, why not stream their shows for audiences? Not that easy. The unions tussled over whether the contracts go to theater workers or the film and TV workers. It was decided, with a lot of restrictions, it should go to the theater workers, the Actors Equity Association. Kate Schindel is the president of that union.
This agreement for us, I believe, was, not to overstate, was a form of triage.
Because the pandemic has really hurt the theater industry, this agreement will allow new productions to stream for consumers willing to pay, just not on the big streaming channels like Netflix or Hulu. Schindel says productions won't end up being as elaborate as Disney Plus's Hamilton. $10, found a father without a father, got a lot. But there's room to experiment.
I would love to see theater shot the way that professional football is shot or tennis is shot.
And as the pandemic drags on, media analyst Tim Hanlon says, we're just hungry for content.
There's a heightened sort of desire from a consumer perspective to truly find something new and different.
Even though this agreement only lasts through the end of next year, Carnegie Mellon professor Michael Smith says this may change things up in the streaming wars.
We've got systems that worked perfectly well in the old way of doing business, where there were bright lines between what is a live production and what's a recorded production.
In this case, now they're both. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Suddenly, it just hit us like a tsunami.
The calls were just pouring in. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials on this Friday afternoon fell 219 points, about 0.7%, closed at 29,263. The NASDAQ off 49 points, about 0.4%, ended at 11,854. The S&P 500 dropped 24.6%, 35.57. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow down 0.7%, the NASDAQ up 0.2%. S&P 500 the other way, gave back 0.8% a day. Stay-at-home stocks got a bump. Telemedicine platform Teladoc improved 4.6%. Peloton, the bike people that isn't really a bike, pumped up 5.3% today. Please don't yell at me. Zoom saw a rise of 6.1% today. Bonds rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 0.82%. People take their Pelotoning very seriously. I know. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hey, remember tariffs? Yeah, they are still happening. China, of course. Also, we have put import taxes on a bunch of European goods, French wine, Scotch whiskey, also Airbus airplanes. But Delta Airlines, a buyer of the aforementioned Airbuses, has been reading the tariff fine print, and it has been paying off. Sid Phillip wrote the story for Bloomberg. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kai.
So in layman's terms here, if you could, what is Delta doing with these new planes?
Yeah, so Delta is doing something really interesting with their new planes. And instead of usually flying them to the US as they have in the past, what they've done instead is fly these planes overseas. Essentially, if the plane has any hours in flight aside from the delivery to the US and testing, that would make it a used plane and no longer subject to tariffs because the tariffs only apply to new planes.
Very tricky. You got to know the laws. So give me an example. Delta plunks down however much money it is for a new Airbus, and it takes off and flies to where and does what?
Sure. So take one plane example, the A321. Delta bought that plane from Airbus, which was built in Hamburg. The plane flew from Hamburg to El Salvador. It stayed there for over 2 weeks. And then from there, it flew to the Cayman Islands and then Atlanta. And most recently, that plane's been flying between Atlanta and Montego Bay.
And it has saved the company. How much money would you guess?
So based on the list prices of the aircraft, it could have saved as much as $270 million. Although airlines don't actually pay the list price for planes. And so the true savings could be much smaller than that, given that most airlines get massive discounts on new plane purchases.
But still, Delta has decided it's worth it to go through this goat rope just to not have to pay however many millions, even single-digit millions of dollars it is in tariffs.
Absolutely. I mean, the U.S. has collected over $55 million in tariffs in the last 1 year or so since the tariffs came in.
What I hear you saying is that other airlines are not doing what Delta's doing and they are paying the tariffs.
Yeah, that would seem like it. It would seem like those airlines are being charged those tariffs.
We should be clear here, too. This is 100% legal, right? I mean, Delta's going by the letter of the law.
Absolutely. I mean, their entire strategy rests on the language that classifies the plane as used once they've flown for any reason other than for testing and delivery.
Even as clever as it might be and as money-saving as it might be, there is some institutional inertia and some inefficiencies that Delta is dealing with here, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the fact that they wouldn't really be able to import those planes directly into the US, and obviously that means you'd have to sort of find places for those planes in the meantime, it does have some impact on their efficiencies. Right. But then remember that you have the COVID crisis at the moment, and that sort of helps because you don't need so many planes at the moment, given the fact that there's so many planes that are on the ground at the moment and airlines are trying everything that they can to save money. So this is one sort of tool in the arsenal.
Sid Phillip, he covers aviation for Bloomberg out of London. Sid, thanks a lot for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Kai, for having me on.
A lot of things, as we all know, have changed in this pandemic, including how we think about risk, what we are willing to do and what we are not. Because spending time indoors with a lot of people around is scary now in ways it wasn't before. There is a labor story in there in more ways than one, as Marketplace's Jasmine Garst reports.
Back in March, when New York City issued its lockdown order, Kim Sun got a voicemail from a pregnant woman she'd never met who was due any day.
You could tell the woman was having a panic attack in the middle of the call. Just the desperation was everywhere.
Sun, a midwife, says the expecting mom was too scared to go to the hospital. Sun specializes in at-home births. She says as hospitals overflowed with COVID patients, she started getting close to 40 calls a day on some days. That's around how many patients she sees a year.
Suddenly, it just hit us like a tsunami. We didn't know what to do. The home birth community became completely swamped.
At-home births have been getting more popular for a while, but are still only about 1% of deliveries. Sun thinks the COVID spike will level off, but with a little more than 12,000 certified nurse midwives in the U.S. right now, many say they're overwhelmed. Historian and certified nurse midwife Michelle Drew says home births used to be the norm in the late 19th and early 20th century, and so were midwives.
90% were Black women and 10% were ethnic immigrants. Physicians still really weren't attending birth because it was not considered, you know, important.
By the 1900s, the American public hospital system was taking root and the narrative changed.
They, you know, essentially demonized the midwives. Why would you possibly want some dirty old Black woman who's probably not literate when you could have a physician?
Giving birth is certainly safer now than it was 100 years ago, but the U.S. now lags behind other wealthy nations when it comes to pregnancy care. And mortality rates have been rising. Studies show hospital births are safer overall, but there's evidence women with low-risk pregnancies can deliver safely at home. One of the reasons mothers choose at-home births is because they don't feel they will be heard or taken care of in a hospital setting. It's particularly a concern for Black women who have 2 to 3 times the maternal mortality rate of white women. Kiki Jordan, a certified professional midwife, says she's gotten a lot more calls from Black expectant mothers.
COVID hit right around the same time that lots of people were starting to talk and there was a lot of awareness gained about outcomes for Black women and Black babies in the hospitals. The combination of those two things, definitely we've seen people actually taking the leap and choosing out of hospital birth. It's been like nothing I've ever seen before.
This was on Brittany Dandy's mind when she found out she was pregnant in March.
Yeah, I was pregnant for the first time. There's a worldwide pandemic. New York City healthcare is falling completely apart. And every headline I read is specifically about Black women, maternal health, and COVID. I knew that I needed to advocate for myself more than, you know, other women.
She did have to consider price. Even with insurance, labor and delivery costs an average of $4,500 out of pocket. And not all insurance plans cover at-home births, which cost anywhere between $4,000 and $8,000. In the end, Dandy's plan did cover it, so she got in touch with Kim Sun, the midwife in Brooklyn, who was starting to get that tsunami of calls from all over the city. Sun was having to turn women who were nearing labor away, but...
You know, we're going to be very honest. If you are a Black woman, we are going to prioritize you first because we know that it's going to be harder for you to get help.
On November 8th, a cool autumn night, Dandy went into labor in her living room with Sun, her husband, and a giant sign, the family mantra.
That says, to be Black and love fully is both a beautiful act of freedom and resistance.
The pandemic was raging on. Presidential politics remained heated. But Dandy says none of that was on her mind when in the quiet of her home in Brooklyn, she gave birth to a baby girl, Aspen James. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, how much dinner next Thursday is going to cost you? The American Farm Bureau Federation has been doing the survey for 35 years. The average cost of a Thanksgiving dinner for 10, $46.90 this year. That is down 4% from a year ago. And that is all in, by the way, turkey, stuffing, sweet potatoes, rolls with butter, peas, cranberry sauce, and a veggie, as well as pumpkin pie with whipped cream and coffee for dessert. But at my table, no peas. Thank you very much. All right, we are out of here, but here is your end-of-the-week moment of economic context, which comes with a reminder that controlling the virus and fixing the economy are the same thing. Pfizer said today it has applied to the Food and Drug Administration for emergency use authorization for its vaccine. No telling how long it's going to take for approval. But Pfizer says could well be that they'll start getting this thing out by the middle or end of December. Limited doses, medical professionals, vulnerable populations, first responders, teachers maybe go first. But all in all, it's good news. Our theme music, BJ Lederman, of course. Nancy Fargali is our executive producer. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Have a great weekend. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.